Welcome to JBJS OrthoCore. Listen as members of the ortho community, residents, surgeons, educators, staff, and patients share their stories about the experiences and people most important in their lives and the lessons they learned along the way. OrthoCore is an audio archive inspired by StoryCore and independently organized by the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
All right. So welcome to another edition of JBJS's OrthoCore. I'm Sanjeev Sabharwal, and today I have the privilege of talking with my mentor and friend, Dr. Hugh Watts. Hugh is a professor emeritus at UCLA and most recently worked at the Shriners in Los Angeles. So good morning, Hugh.
Good morning to you, and I'm glad to be here with you chatting.
Great. Okay, so Hugh, you've been the past president of POSNA. You've served as a historian for that society, and you also founded the POSNA Committee for Outreach in Underserved Regions, you know, just to name a few of your contributions to POSNA. So tell us a little bit and, you know, put on your historian hat and maybe tell us how POSNA evolved and how you see the practice of pediatric orthopedic changing from the time you started training to when you sort of, slow down in terms of clinical practice.
Slow down. The POS, the Pediatric Orthopedic Society, was a very exclusive group of people, and I was a tweener. I was in between, and that I was probably just about the last of the group of POS before it made its major changes. Mm-hmm. And I was at an academy meeting, and they had a group where they were talking about the history of orthopedics, and they had various people talking. Among them was Bob Salter from Toronto, and he was asked to speak about pediatric orthopedics, and his history of pediatric orthopedics was interesting, but I thought it totally missed what I felt was the really essence of the changes that had been going on. He spoke of various interests in different people, and he used publications as the source. I had been involved in the changes, and in part I was the secretary for the POS before it had its amalgamation with the POSG.
POSG for our listeners is the Pediatric Orthopedic Study Group, right?
Study group, that's
and,
right.
And the POS, the Pediatric Orthopedic Society, was more of a very exclusive, you know, by invitation only kind of group. Is that right?
That's right. Okay. And their downfall, really, that made it so difficult at first, was that they decided that they would only allow one person from each major orthopedic center, pediatric orthopedic center, to be a member. And so that meant that somebody like Peterson would be probably forever excluded.
You're talking about Ham Peterson at Mayo?
Yeah, Ham.
Got it.
Ham would have been waiting around for Tony Bianco to die. And I think it turned out that he would have had to wait 20, 30 years, which would have been ridiculous. And so the idea of only having one member from each center was originally set up so that no one center would dominate the whole bunch of groups. But now then... I've now lost my train as to where we were.
Right. No, just to summarize, you know, how did POSNA happen? It sounds like POS and the study group came together. So tell us how that happened.
Yeah. Well, so initially the POS, they were the tried and true, and they really were a distinguished group. In 1969, there were only nine pediatric orthopedic surgeons in the U.S. and Canada that exclusively treated children. And so that's when people decided to maybe they ought to get together and talk to each other. But then when they looked around, they found another function. So by the time the group got together and formalized the Pediatric Orthopedic Society, there were some 21 people who were members, and they were indeed the leaders at the time. But it was this exclusiveness that I was mentioning that made a real problem for the younger ones. Yeah. And the younger ones then just got together a very informal group, and which became known as the Pediatric Orthopedic Study Group. And primarily that was Ann Peterson and
was it Henry Cowell?
Henry, thank you.
Yeah.
This may be a problem with trying to remember some of these details. Henry and Ham were instrumental in forming what they basically sort of thought of themselves as the Young Turks, and that the old folks didn't want to have all these young parts who really wouldn't have the expertise and knowledge that they had. And in some respects, the younger people were a little bit in awe of the olders and were a little afraid. It was a little hard to speak up what you thought about Lake Perthes disease when you had Bob Salter right there looking over your shoulder, who'd made so many contributions to that disease, and so forth. Yeah. So that the this was the initial conflict. But then as time went on, there was more and more amalgamation of the two groups, because the POSG more or less became a farm club of the POS.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that the POS had the prestige.
Yeah.
So that if you were a POS member and they invited you to be a member of the POS rather than POSG, you would jump at the chance because this was acknowledging your welcome into the central core of people.
Yeah.
As these groups started to mingle together, Bob Winder was very instrumental initially in pushing to join the group. This was sort of smoldering, I should say, until the early 73, 74. Uh-huh. And then it sort of finally dawned on people that they couldn't get funding to go to two meetings a year, and there was also taking more time and all of the rest, so that the natural thing happened that they came together.
Yeah.
And at the final coming together, that was at that point I was the secretary of POS, and John Hall was the president. And we were at the same hospital, and therefore that made it a lot easier.
Sure.
And it was easier to kind of push the people into getting together. And so when this finally did happen, it was decided that we would amalgamate them, and they would be called the Pediatric Orthopedic Society, which would have been very good. But unfortunately, as the lawyers looked into things, that the leadership of POS had not been very good about fulfilling their duties to fill in papers for their IRS, and the leadership of POS suddenly found that they were liable for potential problems of a considerable amount of money. And so they decided the answer was to disband. and reformed themselves immediately as a new organization, which was called POSNA, Pediatric Orthopedic Society of North America. Of course, North America didn't include anything south of the southern border of the U.S. And unfortunately, you know, my preference, because I have a general worldview of you know, getting together, it was a shame that that was the choice. Because the goal of POSNA or POS was really to be representative of pediatric orthopedic surgery in the world, and not of North America. But that was an accident of bureaucracy, and we were stuck with it. And other parts of the amalgamation, which I criticized, but no one paid attention to me, was that the emblem that they chose was two crooked trees with one stake to correct it, instead of two stakes to use conjointly for its increased power to correct the one crooked tree in the middle. So we had twice the pathology and only one organization. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Okay, well, this is great. I mean, to hear the backstory, you know, from someone like you who was, you know, very intimately involved in the whole thing. And, you know, there's so much serendipity there. But let's move on to a related theme. You know, I think, interestingly, POSNA came at a time when, you know, orthopedic surgery and pediatric orthopedic surgery was also changing. So, and, you know, you witnessed both sides of this sort of change or chiasm. So tell us, how do you think that took off? How did the clinical practice of pediatric orthopedics that you saw evolved over time?
Yeah, really, the time I spent as a resident was in the old style of pediatric orthopedics. And there really wasn't a history of the safety of using internal fixation in children. That is, if you put a screw into a hip, you know, these children would be living for another 50, 60 years with that screw in them, and we know what the dangers were. And so there was a much greater reliance on either the external fixation or that you would use plaster. And so that as a resident, for example, I spent 3 months as the plaster pop, as we were called, and 3 months entirely treating children with plaster. And so I...
And I'm sorry, this is for like patients with scoliosis or fractures?
Yes,
or
for everything. Oh, you know that... I mean, scoliosis, it's a subject dear to my heart, how that was managed when I was a resident. You know, a child came in with a scoliosis that was going to be operated upon. And the first step was you, as the plaster pump, had the job of making a body jacket for this child. Whether it was the body jacket was first meant that you sewed on a sort of a half-inch thick felt coat, quite literally, where, you know, you tailor it all with tucks and bits and pieces to, so it was nice and smooth. And this then was coated in plaster. Okay, and so then what you did, as you waited about 2 days and till it was good and hard, and then you kind of guessed where the apex of the curve was, and you put a thumbtack in the front of the cast and a thumbtack in the back of the cast, sent that child off to x-ray, or get an x-ray to confirm that your thumbtack was in the right position. Then you cut from the thumbtack on the concave side around to the other thumbtack, all the way through the plaster, and then cut through all the felt. And then on the convex side, you cut out a pie wedge, which created a gap. Oh, I forgot to mention it. Then you plastered in a hinge on top of the cast and on the back of the cast. And then you had to put two little right angle steel things onto the concave side, and which you put a turnbuckle.
Yeah.
And then twice a day, you went to the patient's, the patients came to the pastor room, and you turned that turnbuckle up a couple of turns, and you gradually cranked the child's scoliosis as straight as you could make it over a couple of weeks. And then when that had happened, that was actually the correction.
Yeah.
You didn't do any correction surgically.
Yeah.
That was the surgery. The correction was entirely in the cast.
Yeah.
Then you took the cast off. You had to wait a couple of days to let the skin get nice and cleaned up for the surgery. Then you took the surgery.
Yeah.
And then there were two teams. The team of the spine would open up the spine from guzzle to snatch. They would, they would actually only then decorticate the posterior elements.
Uh-huh.
And we did not cut out the facet joints.
Yeah.
And then, in the meantime, you as the pop had the privilege of taking a osteoperiosteal graft from the tibia.
Uh-huh.
And you were operating simultaneously with the knee bent 90 degrees.
Oh, so the patient is prone.
Patient is prone, right. Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. Then you cut out a piece of graft that went from the very proximal tibia to the very distal, avoiding the growth plates.
Uh-huh.
And it was a centimeter and a half wide.
Uh-huh.
And it was about a millimeter of cortical graft, which was left intact on the periosteum.
Uh-huh.
Then you close this up, and hopefully you had this graft, and it was one piece.
Uh-huh.
And it had to be one piece, and that your skills were judged on the basis of this. And you were a junior orthopedic resident, so that was a stressful time.
Yeah.
Then this was handed to the surgeon in the operating end, and then the spinal end, who would take a towel clip and cut a hole in the end, one end of this periosteal graft, put in a suture, and he would sew this graft into the uppermost spinous process left behind.
Yeah.
And then this graft was laid down in its bed, so you had an end-for-end total graft.
So your extent of fusion, your extent of fusion was based on the length of the tibia and the graft you took. Is that true?
Yes.
Wow.
Basically.
Wow.
And then you close them all up, and you waited a couple of days to know that the child was doing all right and was able to eat and all the rest. And then you, as the plaster pup, had the job to put them into a new body jacket, body cast. On this cast included not only the trunk, but included the arm on the convex side and the leg to the knee on the concave side, and that you then put them again in the put on hinges and located the hinges by the clips, by the thumbtacks, and then you took the two or three days, a very short time, to regain all of the bend that you had created before the operation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's huge. But tell me, so there was no orthotist. Sounds like a lot of this is something.
We get there. We get there.
Okay.
Okay. So now you've got this, and the child has now got a bend in the cast, which she usually was going to spend 6 months in bed lying down. Okay, and so she would get little prism glasses so that she could read. And she would go home wearing this cast for 6 months.
Yeah.
So 6 months later, she'd come into the hospital, and you as the pastor pup would see her again, and you'd cut off the cast.
Yeah.
And it was your job then to make a plaster model, I guess you call it. And so you would stand this girl up who hadn't been standing for 6 months, and she was pretty weak and wobbly, and she would be held up with a chin next, a jaw and occiput strap. At which point, you as a plaster pope would then now put on a new but unlined, well, there was a stockinette, but no felt, plaster jacket, which then went from iliac, just below the iliac crest, to the upper thorax.
Yeah.
And when this set up, which was just, not that many minutes later, you would cut that off. The child would be then put back into bed, and that mold was sent to the orthotist.
Got it.
Who then filled up the mold, which then provided you with a solid plaster that with a steel pipe going through it.
Wow.
Now, you as the orthopedic resident were responsible to modify that mold so that it was, you would have to carve a little off the prominences and pad in where concavities were so that the new shape was somewhat corrective.
Wow.
And then you worked down in the dungeon. I mean, it was a little, a room, not much bigger than a closet. And there was a vise, and you put this mold of the steel central thing, and you took, two handled scrapers and modeled this whole thing around. And when it was a satisfactory shape, you then used Celastic, which was a sort of plastic. You then dipped that into acetone. And this OSHA would have died if it knew what you were. And you then made a Celastic jacket out of this mold. And then you turn that over to the orthotist, who then put buckles on the front with sliding bars that would keep the sides of the of this brace from sliding north and south. And so then you saw the patient then a couple of weeks later in the outpatient department, and this girl had to wear that thing for another 6 months. And this was treating, this was surgically treating a child with scoliosis.
Yeah.
And the difference was that, it was just about that time, as I was finishing up my residency, that Harrington had been working on his rod that was finally being accepted.
Yeah.
But the whole idea was, goodness, you couldn't leave metal in the child for a zillion years.
Yeah.
And so you as a resident certainly became very, very close to the patient.
Yeah.
You've had a lot of dealings with the patient, and that this is the part about orthopedics that was children's orthopedics, which has changed so much. But it was very, very different from general orthopedics at the time.
Yeah.
And that treating of a dislocated hip, there were no Pavlik stirrups. You put them into a body cast and incorporated their legs into abduction and some flexion.
Yeah.
Not as much flexion as sort of went into the Pavlik stirrup, et cetera. But anyway, and these children would wear these casts for 6 months.
Yeah.
They'd have to be changed if you're getting a child young enough that the growth demanded.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing was that the parents would tolerate this.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't sort of given an opportunity.
I know.
This was the way you had to be treated.
Yeah.
And that, I don't think that current orthopedic surgeons who are in the pediatric world really recognize, how much plaster was used in those days. And for children with cerebral palsy, they all, regardless of any surgery they had, they all wore night casts.
Yeah.
We would have to put on casts that were then treated by the cast technicians to, you know, with line with coated with Celastex to make them more permanent and so forth.
Yeah.
And that was a whole world that made the world of orthotics much clearer to your heart.
Yeah.
I think you understood much better what the needs were of making orthoses for children.
Yeah.
And this was, I think, what helped me certainly in the early development of the Boston Brace, which I was very much involved in, because I'd had to carve these models, and I had to work at all of this, and that's, it was natural to be very, very cognizant of what the authors had to do, and I think it helped a great deal. Anyway, that's a whole lot of area that's of interest.
Yeah.
I don't think that a person who now treats a child surgically for scoliosis, where the child goes in and, you know, has everything all done right there, the exposure was much more extensive, much more bone removed, and that then, you know, the correction was the rod that you used right then and there, and then a couple weeks later they're home and walking, and that you know, it's just a different world entirely.
Yeah, it's definitely different, and I guess in most people's eyes, better. But I think there's something to be said with the personal experience and growth you had as a trainee. So
I think so. It's much, much better for a child now, and hugely better for a parent, and so on. But I think as a trainee, I fully appreciated the experience that I had, and I feel that, you know, it's something that current trainees are missing, which is the same, of course, getting us into a topic that both you and I are familiar with and dear to our hearts, which is polio.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I was a resident at that time, the polio was more or less controlled in the U.S. Because of the vaccine. But there were huge numbers of children who had been, who had suffered from polio, but who then were still dealing with the consequences.
Yeah.
And so that we would have three polio clinics a week in the outpatient with a couple hundred children each.
Wow.
And so, and that again with the bracing of it, you know, with a child who would be in a KAFO, which we used to call long leg brace, you learned that the angle of the ankle controlled the hip, so that if a child had weak gluteus maximus, you needed to extend the hip enough to get the center of gravity behind the hip so it wouldn't collapse and weight bearing, which meant that you had to dorsiflex the ankle. Well, it was our job with bending irons, where we would adjust the the stops on the ankle to gain the amount of dorsiflexion, which would give you the hip extension that you needed for that.
Yeah.
And so this, you didn't send them to the orthotist. You sent them to, and the word orthotist didn't exist then. That was the brace man.
Yeah.
You sent them to the brace shop later, but at the time we were residents, we did that ourselves. So that, you know, this gave you much better appreciation of biomechanics and of the management of children, so that by the time you and I went off to Tajikistan, which was what, 2012, was it?
Yeah, around that.
I think that's right. And that, you know, it was an epidemic for those who were listening. It was almost 1,000 children developed polio. And I think most of the world totally ignored it.
Yeah.
And I think it was enough of an embarrassment for the country that they didn't. They didn't advertise it. And so you had a huge group of kids with polio, fresh.
Yeah.
But there was almost nobody who had any experience in the treating of this.
Yeah.
So it felt as though it was a, certainly a natural and easy thing for my wife is a pediatric physical therapist, and she had a lot of experience with polio herself. And so when we went to Tajikistan, you know, to assess the situation, it was like old home week. But it, I think for most pediatric orthopedic surgeons now, they may not have ever seen or managed a child with the long-run consequences of polio.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you, of course, you and Sharon and some of us, you know, compiled this book on polio with global help and Lynn Staley's, you know, support. So I think that's a great resource to archive, because isn't like the polio-like diseases coming back even in the U.S.? And isn't it relevant for trainees today?
Well, I think there are two things. You know, polio, in the U.S., people think that vaccinations, you know, it cured polio or got rid of it. Well, it didn't at all. It just controlled it. Yeah. And that even today, you know, when you do analyses of effluent from the toilets of New York, or even as you know, in the last few years, there's polio still in the sewage.
Yeah,
polio is everywhere, and that it's not causing its bad problems because of vaccination, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's I think to think that it's going to go away is you know, since 85, was it 85 that the World Health Organization set out to get rid of polio, which was hubris at its maximum. And you know, they here it is, or, you know, 35 years later, and it's still there. And any time war or any time, you know, there's economic downturn where children in countries don't get vaccinated, that polio springs right back up again.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, the variants, which are unrelated, which give paralyses that... that are all similar to what we used to see following polio, that these are sort of met with confusion, really, on the part of most pediatric orthopedists these days, because it's a group of kids that they have not treated before.
Yeah. Right. Well, I would love to keep talking, but I think time's going to run out soon. So why don't, I mean, you know, you have such a rich experience, and thanks for sharing all this. Just a final thought or two on, you know, you've had a global perspective, I think. I mean, you know, you were born in Japan, you know, you sort of took the scenic route. I think after medical school, you went to Afghanistan for a couple of years. Then you did immunology in England after residency, and of course, all these overseas trips. So tell us, like, if a trainee both here in North America and rest of the world was listening, and you wanted to give them like a couple of sound bites of advice based on your experience, what are the do's and don'ts for a trainee and a young surgeon taking care of pediatric orthopedics?
You know, that's an almost impossible task, because, I mean, there are two problems. One is that you want to go over and you want help other people, and yet you have to realize that you can only really make a significance if you can leave something that's sustainable.
Yeah.
So the mere fact of just going over and doing things, I think, is maybe self-satisfying, and it feels good to pat yourself on the back, but it doesn't really do anything if teaching isn't a major part of your goal.
Yeah.
And the problem is, in order to teach, you need to be skilled enough to have something to offer.
Yeah.
So that while I went right after my internship to Afghanistan, I was there, this was so 61, 62, I had a lot to offer because my just general training was better than what the local medical people had, but in order to really make an impact, I would have to come back and get trained.
Yeah.
So one thing, though, is that you don't want to, in coming out and getting trained for this, you have two choices, and you can get trained so that you can go back and do anything.
Yeah.
In which case, people feel, gosh, I better take cardiac surgery and be able to, you know, do anything like that, just in case I'm the one person that's there. But some basic good skills are what you want to teach. But the problem is your family depends on your wife. My first child was born in Afghanistan, and she was a year and a half when she left. Usually it's a great time to go with children because they have a lot to learn, and it gives them a sense of their role in the world rather than just in their little community.
Yeah.
There comes a point then when, you know, if when they're 6 or 8, you don't want to have to send them off to private schools or boarding schools. So that's a little difficult. Yeah. So you end up being on this side of the divide, and can spend a couple of weeks here and a couple of weeks there each year. And that's how I then later spent much of my time. And I think that is useful. But the important thing is that it's not your doing, it's what you leave behind.
Yeah.
It's sustainability.
Yeah.
And that I can't emphasize that enough. And that, you know, it may, when you're going over to stick an arthroscope in your pocket because, you know, there's an extra one of them around, doesn't do much good when the bulb is broken. And, as I said, a lot of places you go to, there's just no consistent electricity that you're going to be able to use to light up the bulb, even if you had a supply of
it. Yeah.
So that you have to choose the technology that you are going to offer to something which is meaningful for them, and that that it's something that they can grow with.
Yeah.
But bringing high technical stuff isn't even though that's what they want.
Yeah.
It makes them feel good, and the pediatric or the surgeon overseas would love to be able to stick in a rod and fix the scoliosis and wow everybody, but you need people to follow them up. You need technology to do it safely, so that you have to be very cautious about the technology you want to transfer.
Okay, very good. Good words to live by, and thank you so much, Hugh. This has been such a pleasure and an honor. You've been my lifelong friend, mentor, philosopher, guide, everything. So thank you for spending the time, and say my hello to Sharon.
I will.
We'll talk later. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Sanjay.